Prabhupada would say, you find that hard to believe, but actually Krishna says, I am the seed-giving father of everyone. So this, just that this small group of people is considered my direct family, isn't actually so hard to believe. But one day, some of the sons and grandsons of Krishna, some of the princes in the Yadu dynasty, they went into the forest around Dwarka to have a picnic. And they were going here and there. And in the course of their excursion, they became a little thirsty. And so when they became thirsty, they looked around for somewhere to get some water to drink. So they looked around and they saw a well. And they thought, oh, this is very good. So they were going to reach down into the well and see if they could get some water. But when they looked inside the well, they saw that the well was actually empty of water. And a long way down in the well was a very big living entity. It was a big, huge lizard. And the lizard was caught at the bottom of the well and actually couldn't get out of the well by any means. So the boys, feeling a little bit concerned and astonished to see the wonderful animal, they thought, let's help him out of the well. So they reached down as best they could to try to help him, pull him out, but they couldn't get him out of the well. So then they said to themselves, let's go home and ask our father, he'll come. So they went back to the palace and they said to Krishna, we saw this huge lizard in a well, he was stuck, please come and take him out. So Krishna, he felt very compassionate also for the lizard, and so he personally went to the well. And he easily got the great lizard out of the well simply by extending his left hand. Not right hand, left hand. So, but when he reached down to touch the lizard, to bring the lizard up out of the well, the lizard transformed. And there was no longer any lizard there. But instead a very, very effulgent, handsome, dynamic, powerful looking man was standing there with a crown and an aura and luster and beautiful regal clothes on. And everybody was looking, all the boys were looking at him. It was most astonishing. Imagine if you went to the zoo or somewhere in the park. Yeah. I went to the park with Nana today and a man came by with his dog. Imagine if you gave him a pat on the head and he almost turned into a great sparkling young man from the heavens. You'd be like quite astonished. What is this transformation? So in this way they were surprised. The great lizard gave up his former shape and appeared as a beautiful demigod. His bodily complexion was like gold, and he was decorated in fine garments, and he wore costly ornaments around his neck. So then everybody was wondering, as you can imagine, what was this? How did this take place? So Krishna, in order, although he knew everything, he knew what had happened here. For the other's information, the Lord inquired, and he said, because he saw this was actually a demigod, he was so great. And so he said to him, my dear fortunate demigod, I see that your body is so beautiful and lustrous. Who are you? We can guess that you are one of the best demigods in the heavenly planets. I think that you are not meant to be in this situation. It must be due to the results of your past activities that you have been put into this position. If you think that you can disclose the secret, then please tell me, how did you get into this situation? So when questioned by Krishna, this, he was actually a king, this king, he bowed his hands very respectfully, and then he touched with his helmet, he had a beautiful shining helmet, he touched his helmet to the ground in front of Krishna, and then he was preparing himself to speak. He said, my dear Lord, I am the son of King Ikshvaku. So who knows who King Ikshvaku is? Where have we heard his name? In Bhagavad Gita. Who is he the son of? Who is the son of the sun god? Who is the son of the sun god? I think it's Ikshvaku. Yeah. So Ikshvaku is the son of a very, very, one of the topmost demigods. He's his son. And his name was Mriga. He said, my name is King Mriga. And if you have ever heard or taken account of charitably disposed men, you must have heard my name. He was humble. He said, "My Lord, you are the witness. You are aware of every bit of work done by the living entities, past, present, and future, and nothing can be hidden from you. Still, you have ordered me to explain, and I will tell you my story." So he said that he was very... He began to narrate the history of his degradation. Prabhupada uses this word, degradation, although it doesn't sound like he's a very degraded person. It sounds like he's a very elevated person, which was caused by his karmakanda activities. He was extremely charitably disposed and had given away so many cows that it said that the number of cows that he'd given away... Now, this number is fantastic, so there you have to understand, oh, who he is. He's the son of the sun god, so he can do something fantastic. But he had given away as many cows as was equal to the amount of dust on the earth. So he really was charitably disposed, inconceivably. He'd been giving and giving and giving and giving. He wasn't a miserly man. He was giving and giving and giving. But we're going to hear how he became degraded. So this is interesting. So he said, "I gave away as many cows equal to the amount of dust on the earth, stars in the sky, and rainfall." So he was very astonishing. He said, "According to the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, a man who is charitably disposed is commanded to give cows to Brahmins." And so this is what he was doing. And any Brahmin who came to him, he would give him as many cows as he wanted. And not only that, he said, "I would give him a village, I would give him a house. If he wasn't married, I would give him a wife, I would give him maid servants, I would give him anything. I was very, very, very attached to serving Brahmanas. So I was giving and giving and giving." And this is recommended in Bhagavad Gita. But still, how could he have become degraded? He's following everything rightly. He said, "To give charity means to perform pious activities. And I have performed so many pious activities. And the cows were not ordinary cows." He was very particular. "Each one was very young, had only one calf. They were full of milk, very peaceful, very healthy. He did everything nicely. He wasn't just careless in his charity. And I would put gold plating on their horns, and their hooves would be decked with silver plates, and they were covered in silken wrappers." So he was really into it. They had pearl necklaces around them. He was getting this whole thing, what he was doing. He was really seriously charitable. He was going on and on, and the Brahmins were well qualified. None of them were very rich. The family was not in want. I did this. I did everything very, very nicely. He said, "But in spite of all this, I did such nice things. But one day, one Brahmin, I gave him so many cows." So he took his cows, he was going on his way home. "And another Brahmin came. And the second Brahmin came, and I wanted to give him cows. So unfortunately, unbeknown to him, one cow of the group of cows from the first Brahmin wandered back into his herd. And so then he gave away a second group of cows to the second Brahmin, and the second Brahmin was going home. And the first Brahmin looked over his herd of cows and saw that one cow was missing. And so he came back to the king and said, 'One of my cows is missing, where's the cow?' And then he saw, 'There's my cow,' in the group that the other Brahmin was taking away. He said, 'That cow's mine.' And the other Brahmin said, 'That cow's mine.' And he said, 'No, no, I was given that cow.' He said, 'I was given that cow.' He said, 'I was given the cow first.' 'That may be, but I was given the cow also.' And all of a sudden they started to fight. And both of the Brahmanas started to say, 'Oh, this is my cow.' 'No, no, it's my cow.' And then the other one saying, 'It's my cow. I'm sorry, it's my cow.' And they started to come into a very conflicting situation. And the king became very worried, because this was going to be a real smear on his service. So the king, he tried to stop them from fighting. And he said to them, he promised them both that he would give them each, he promised, 'I will give you another 10,000 cows if you stop fighting. I'm your servant, please, I'm trying to do this for you. Please don't quarrel with each other.' And neither of the Brahmins would agree. And they both left that place angry with the king. There was a misunderstanding and he couldn't resolve it. And both of these Brahmins went home and both of them thought that the king was irreligious for doing this. So they disagreed with the king's proposal and both Brahmins left the palace in anger, thinking that their lawful position had been usurped. So sometime after that, it doesn't say how long, it became time for the king to give up his life. And he was taken before the superintendent of death, Yamaraj. And Yamaraj asked him a question. He said to him, "Would you like to first of all suffer the reactions of your impious activities? Or would you like to first of all enjoy the results of your pious activities?" Yamaraj hinted that since the king had executed so many pious activities and charities, the limit of his enjoyment was unknown to him. How much enjoyment from all these pious activities was waiting for him, he couldn't imagine. There was practically no end to the king's material happiness. But in spite of this hint, he became confused. And he decided to first suffer the results of his impious activities, get the suffering out of the way, and after the suffering was out of the way, then I could enjoy and enjoy and enjoy and enjoy. This was his reasoning. So he agreed, he decided to first suffer the results of his impious activities, and then to accept the results of his pious activities, and therefore Yamaraj immediately turned him into a lizard. And there he was. He had all of this piety waiting for him, but he'd done something that was impious against his will. And therefore, he was in this position. So when I was speaking to Gopal, I was talking to Gopal about the point that when you're trying to do things, no matter what they are, on your own account, it's risky, because here we're talking about a degradation. He didn't do anything degrading. He only did good things. But a degradation occurred in his situation. So this is the risk of the material world. And here King Riga is going to experience it. But did he lose because he had so much piety? Did he lose everything? No, he didn't. He didn't lose everything. But he had to stay in the well as a big lizard for a very long time. He told Krishna, "In spite of being put into that degraded condition of life, I simply thought of you, my dear Lord, and my memory was never vanquished." It appears from these statements of King Riga that persons who follow the principles of fruitive activities and derive some material benefits are not very intelligent. Being given the choice by the superintendent of death, Yamaraj, King Riga could have first accepted the results of his pious activities, but he thought it would be better to first receive the effects of his impious activities and then enjoy the effects of his pious activities without any disturbance. But on the whole, he had not developed, as Srila Prabhupada adds, just for our benefit, on the whole, he had not developed Krishna consciousness. So it's very interesting because we're going pious, impious, pious, impious, but he hadn't developed Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada says. The Krishna-conscious person develops love of God, Krishna, not love for pious or impious activities. Therefore, he is not subjected to the results of such action. As stated in the Brahma Samhita, a devotee, by the grace of the Lord, does not become subjected to the resultant reactions of fruitive activities. So this is obviously something that we can say, well, I'm not that great a devotee, I do pious and impious activities, obviously I'm going to be affected. But here he's saying that even a devotee who tries to please Krishna is not subject to the results of pious or impious activities. He is dealt with by Krishna himself. He arranges all of what is necessary to bring that devotee upward. But King Riga, because he was so pious, he had an advantage. He explained that as a result of his pious activities, King Riga had developed an aspiration to see the Lord. So this, interestingly enough, comes from his pious activities, as it's described here, that he started to want to see the Lord. And because he had this very strong desire that sometime he may be able to see him, he said, I think that my tendency to perform ritualistic and charitable activities, on one side, combined with this great desire to see you personally, this is interesting, has enabled me to retain the memory of who I was in my former life, even though I became a lizard. So he was able to retain the memory of what happened to him, why, how he got into this difficult situation. Because of a combination of his pious activities and the desire that he had developed to actually see Krishna. So this is, I think, has some relevance to ourselves also. Then he says, you are the super soul seated in everyone's heart, and there are many mystic yogis who have the eyes to see you through the Vedas. Therefore, I am very much surprised, though, that I am able to see you personally, because I know I was engaged in so many things, especially as a king. Although I was in the midst of luxury and opulence and was subject to so many worldly things, I am so fortunate to be seeing you personally. As far as I know, when one becomes liberated from material life, then he can see you in this way. So he was seeing him even though he wasn't actually eligible. He understood that. So then Srila Prabhupada goes on and he describes the conversation that takes place between Krishna and King Riga. And Krishna, he glorifies him and he benedicts him. And then King Riga says that because you have given me back this body of a demigod, I have to go now to the heavenly planets. But I am taking this opportunity to beg for your mercy, that I may have the benediction now, at this point, instead of to continue with my heavenly activities, my pious activities, that no matter in what form of life I am transferred, that I will always, always, always be able to remember you. This was now what he had come to. Before it was doing these pious activities, by doing this I'm going to get so much enjoyment and I don't do bad things so I won't have any suffering. And now he had come to a different level of life. So then Krishna, he speaks to the boys, because King Riga, then he disappears, he circumambulates and then he disappears through the heavenly planets, having received his benediction. And then Krishna speaks to the boys present, his sons, and he talks to them about how dangerous it is to take a Brahmin's property. And this is actually the key point that is very clear, but I want people to hear and think about this even further. So he says, my dear boys and relatives, I therefore advise you that even if a Brahmin becomes angry with you and calls you ill names and cuts you, still you should not retaliate. On the contrary, you should smile, tolerate him, and offer your respects to that Brahmin. You know very well that even if I myself offer my obeisances to the Brahmins with great respects 3 times daily, then you therefore should follow my instructions and example. I shall not forgive anyone who does not follow them, and I will punish them. You should learn from the example of King Riga that even if someone unknowingly usurps the property of a Brahmana, he is put into a miserable condition of life, even if it's unknown. Thus the Lord, who is always engaged in purifying the conditioned living entities, gave instruction not only to his family members and the inhabitants of Dwarka, but to all the members of human society, and then he entered his palace. Now, one time that this story came up before I asked him, you may be struggling, but I ask you some questions, is when Srila Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. It must have been in the early 70s. And there's some land was given to Srila Prabhupada that is now the place where the Krishna Balaram Mandir and Srila Prabhupada's Samadhi rests in Vrindavan. And one night, Srila Prabhupada called Satsrut Maharaj, you may have read this in the Lilamrita. I had the good fortune of hearing Satsrut Maharaj tell the story directly, years and years and years ago, when it was very near to having just happened, that he called him into his room as his servant, and he said to him, I want you to dictate this letter. And then Srila Prabhupada was sitting there, as Srila Prabhupada in a very grave mood, and he started to dictate a letter. And in the letter, he started telling this story. And while he was telling the story, Satchitananda described at the time, he became very nervous because he thought, why is Prabhupada telling me this story? Why is he asking me to dictate this letter? Because Srila Prabhupada was very grave and heavy. And he thought of all the things that he'd done. And he said he remembered that he had taken a pair of socks that had been given to Srila Prabhupada, that he knew Srila Prabhupada would wear that pair of socks because they weren't the right color or something. It was so cold in Vrindavan and he was feeling the cold, and so he quietly put the pair of socks into his suitcase, and he had taken them and he was wearing them, and he was going through his mind. He said he was getting more and more and more terrified as he was writing the letter, and Prabhupada was talking about stealing a Brahmin's property, and even if it's done unconsciously, and he was thinking about what was being told to him. And then at the very end, after he had asked him to dictate this letter and he had told this whole story, then he said, you please send this letter to Mrs. S. We used to call her Mrs. Sharaford, who was the wife of the man who was taking back the property from the Krishna Balaraman, who had given it, and then he was sort of hedging and saying, actually, I think we need the front part, you can have the back part. So he was sending a letter there, and he said, Anugun, he told us that many years ago, he was just squirming inside through the whole letter. And Srila Prabhupada had the power to make you do that, like just completely feel like you're going to die right now. And then at the end, to release you from that position so that you actually felt an enormous relief. So this was the time that I remember most succinctly hearing this story being told to somebody who wanted to take back something that they were giving to Srila Prabhupada. But how does this story apply to us? We're not taking back, are we? Or aren't we? Or how does it apply to us? Does anyone have any thoughts?
Probably the most significant thing that I was thinking of is just that in our dealings with devotees, because that we're reading Brahmana is one level, but somebody who's trying to dedicate their life to Krishna, that's another level altogether. So when dealing with devotees or aspiring devotees, how important it is to develop respect and careful dealings in everything that we do, things that we say, and in our exchanges, and to actually try and make the exchanges as sweet as possible to avoid offences being committed, which displeases Krishna.
That's a very straight to the point. What else? Does anyone else have anything to add to that? To enhance that point? Thank you.
When devotees please Krishna by performing wonderful devotional service, it like supersedes all pious activities and step higher than that.
I think that was the point that first struck me when I was speaking of it this afternoon, and when I read it, your point became very clear. But I was thinking about that one has to know what is pious activity and what is bhakti, and sometimes because we don't go through with our definitions, we don't take them into our lives, and sort of scan things by the definition, we don't understand it. We do something that's not to Krishna's pleasure and think that it's devotional because it's a good thing. But actually, Krishna has to be there for it to be devotional. Not only your family, not only your country, not only your community, Krishna has to be there as well for it to be devotional. And does that bring anything to anyone's mind they would like to ask a question or Sachi?
I was just thinking that for me it means like to be such a half-hearted devotee like myself, sort of not completely sort of dedicated. There's automatically so many implications, and obviously I'm fully dedicated to Krishna, I'm just thinking, just take it easy. And there's obviously some reactions accumulating, and I'm just not taking it seriously at all. And seeing that this pious person who was obviously
Sincere in his piety.
Well, because he was thinking of Krishna when he was with it, him as the big devotee, as a king of ego. And I'm thinking of myself, I'm not only offending brahmanas and devotees, I'm just doing, you know, so much stuff and not actually taking food. So even if I was thinking I'm a devotee, that's not going to work actually. I'm not actually able to be on that platform. So for me, it's just like,
So what can we do about that? Any suggestions to somebody who sees that, you know, I'm a devotee, sort of a, so much a devotee, but there's some parts aren't quite fully dedicated? Would that sound unfair as a description?
Yeah.
So what do we do? Any advice for someone like that?
Well, part of the process of humility is to cultivate the consciousness that we're actually going backwards.
Yes.
That's humility.
Yeah. That's a funny thing, isn't it? You know that story from Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakura?
Yes, that's
the one. Want to tell that story?
It's a bit rusty.
I'm a bit rusty too, but the gist of it was that two of his disciples were sitting talking together. And they were just thinking, you know, actually not making any advancement at all. I actually talk to sometimes older devotees and they tell me this. I don't feel like I'm making any advancement. In fact, I feel like I'm going backwards. So these two brahmacharis were discussing like this. I just feel like I'm going backwards. I'm not really making any progress. And then he came to speak with them, where they took their plight to him and they said, we just feel like we're just not going anywhere. And he told them. He basically said something to the effect. What I understood from that was that as you become more advanced, you'll see how far back you are. When you first start out, you think I'm really racing up here and getting this all taken care of, and then gradually you sort of see all the places that you're not. And so then one can have a bit of a disappointment at that point and can feel that, oh, this, I'm not really getting anywhere here, it is a bit hopeless. And if one knows that that's part of the process to come through that, to develop humility, then one can regain strength and keep moving forward instead of becoming like, oh, I guess this is pretty hopeless. But this is, you have to sort of feel your own fallenness, your own vulnerability. And Krishna makes an arrangement for each one of us how to feel our own vulnerability. And we have to say that's his mercy when he does that. And we should take hold of it. I one thing here, let me hear some more and I'll see if anyone else brings up this one thing that struck me here.
If Maya is under Krishna's supervision, then somehow it was organized for him to fall down. So we got to see it as mercy, but I'll see it as a...
No, because the living entity has infinitesimally small freedom. The living entity is small and has a small degree of free will. So Maya's actions follow his decisions with his own free will. It's not like a predator who's going to get you no matter what you do. But when you make a choice to do something, the consequences of that may not be what you thought the consequences of it were, because you're one small individual in the whole world, right? And there's so many people and they all have making choices and so on and so forth. So Maya regulates the actions and reactions of things that happen, but you've got space to make a choice to go more and more and more towards Krishna. Always that's there. That's the point I was going to bring out, was that the king, because he was doing this ritualistic pious activity, and also because of, what was the other reason he remembered? Because he had a desire. See, he had a desire already, but he was doing something else. He wasn't following his desire at that time. He was doing the pious things, but he had a desire to see Krishna. And so because of those two things, he was able to see how he got to the point that he got to. What happened? He didn't see it, that somebody did this to me. He saw that I took this step and this step and this step and this step and I got to this point. And his memory of Krishna wasn't lost. It's a hard one to accept, that we have only a very minute amount of independence, but within that amount of independence There's a huge amount of freedom if we do use it properly. And if we don't use it properly, there's a huge amount of implication that can come in, because we're just a tiny fragmental part of the whole universe. We don't normally see like that. We kind of see it's a sort of a symptom that we think that I'm kind of the center of my universe. I have a life that comes all around me. But we don't necessarily have a perception that my little universe is part of so many multitude of things. Like in this room, there's unlimited living entities in this room. When we chant Hare Krishna, they all get benefited. That's why we chant loudly. But how they got into this room and all, we can't understand any of that. All we know is I'm in the room. So the material, the universe is very, very, very elaborate. So when we set out, I want to do this, we don't know what the effects will be. We think we do, but we don't, because we're small. But we have freedom. But it's only tiny freedom. Not as big as we'd like. We have freedom. We're not being stalked. Go on, say it.
I guess that I don't know how to convince myself about it. I seem to try to understand what you're saying, and I come to the same question eventually, is that it seems that way, but at the same value opposite is the counter effect, that it seems not that we have no free choice. It seems to be all organized in a way that you seem to do what you're doing, and you don't seem to have any real, even smallest choice in life.
It seems like that, but it's funny. This doesn't, until one has gone a certain way on the journey of spiritual development, one doesn't see it as being a very astonishing thing that one is chanting Hare Krishna. In the beginning, it's like, could take it or leave it. But if one continues to chant Hare Krishna, one realizes that through chanting Hare Krishna, one's consciousness becomes actually capable of choosing to leave the whole material atmosphere completely. You've suddenly got a real choice. Now your choices are like, do you want this color of this or that color of that, or your that country or this country, this house or that house? They're not very big choices. But when it comes to the point of, do you want to develop love for God? Then, by chanting Hare Krishna, you're starting on that journey. And every time you're making a choice for that, you're actually gaining freedom. But you never, ever, ever become the whole thing. So you never, ever, ever, not under some influence, but you come under the spiritual influence, which is Krishna's influence, or you come under that, just like a king, right? He's the king, you're a citizen. You can be in the jail, under the influence of the jail. You can be in the kingdom, under the influence of the government. But in both ways, your king is there and you're there. Do you follow? But you can be in the jail, or you can be outside. It's like that. Okay, any other
In the beginning, I found quite interesting how the king, he actually, even though he knows Krishna is present there, he actually comes to the point of bringing his testimony before Krishna and the princes as a significant humility to actually show them how he made a mistake, and he owns the problem and somehow is able to expose, if you like, himself.
Yeah.
And that's a great benefit to,
yes,
if we hear from others,
yeah,
in a very genuine way.
I guess he's had time to think about it a lot. You imagine, I'm like, because I could go to sleep tonight, and you wake up in the morning, instead of, you know, two arms and two legs, you've got little things that stick out like this. You wake up in the morning and say, oh, Ramila, I've got a bit of a problem here. You need to get into the bath. You flip into the bath. And then you had to sit there for a few hundred years, you know, and sort of like, you go through the whole thing anyway. I was thinking, he had a long time to think about it, you know, like, and he remembered it all. And so then you start putting it together how I got into this situation. And like, because sometimes what happens is if you make a mistake and somebody says, what did you do? You don't know what you did. You know, it's sort of just, it just happened. Like if you say, even a child, they knock something, why did you do that? They're like confused. I don't know, you know, they just kicked it or something like that. But if you have to sit there for a long time looking at it, then when somebody says, what did you do? Well, yeah, I can explain it to you. So he was able to actually explain the whole thing. But he had one other thing that made him enabled him to explain it. He really wanted to see Krishna. Right? He remembered all the things, but he wanted to see him. So because he wanted to see him, when he saw him, he was very relieved. He was very happy to see him. So I think that would have to be considered part of his bravery. Mm-hmm. You know, he spent time thinking, meditating on his problems, and then he saw Krishna directly. So we may not see Krishna, may not walk in and touch us and save us from others of like lifetime lifestyles, but he's there, and he sometimes makes his presence felt, and then it's as if it releases some kind of a sense of disappointment or confusion. You know, what a disaster that all sort of seems to be. It evaporates in the presence of Krishna's mercy. That was what I was thinking. Mm. You know, that I found that interesting, that he retained his desire, he retained the memory of who he was because of his pious activities and the desire he had to see Krishna, these two things together. Any other points on that?
Well, one other thing that I was thinking of, that just by living in this material world, even though it doesn't seem... seems an unfairness almost there, that he got punished in such a way for seemingly something that he wasn't directly responsible for. But just by living in this world, like Prabhupada uses the analogy, there's like pieces of bamboo that in the forest, it catches fire, and even out of our control or order, we find ourselves implicated in. In situations which
you run a risk. Just to live in this world, you run a risk. And then we might think like that, that's not fair, why we have to be put in a risky place. But then we understand from Bhagavad Gita that Krishna keeps saying, I was saying to you, Miller's up and we're talking to him, he says over and over and over again, don't stay here. This isn't the right place for you. There's a very nice place. I've made a very nice place where you're meant to be, don't stay here. And we keep saying, what? I didn't understand that. I've got a lot of things going on for me here. I can't possibly leave all the things that I've got here. But actually, he's constantly, if we're actually sincere, if we're just ploughing on with life, we may not hear him, but he's also within the heart. And through the super soul, he's trying to give the same message. The message is there in written form. It's also, he's trying to direct it through our intelligence. But somehow or another, it's very difficult for us sometimes to want to stop long enough to hear it. We've got our agendas for being here. But that's the point that I found also reading, is that it's risky if you're doing things on your own behalf. And as it's said in here, that if somebody is working on behalf of Krishna, they don't suffer that risk.
That's a lot of times you find that's a difficult situation is the impetus to become more serious too. Because without that, we just coast.
There's a good point. A difficult situation is the impetus to become more serious, because without that we just coast along, thinking that everything's great, I'm doing fine, everything's okay, but there's a challenge in a difficult situation. So then a difficult situation sometimes ends up looking like a great blessing after you've sort of mastered the lessons that are, you know, being offered through. Afterwards, sometimes after a difficult situation, sometime after you reflect about it, you think, I could never have learnt that in any other way. I don't think I would have ever learnt it either if it hadn't happened this way. You know, both ways, you see, wow, that's amazing. That's as if Krishna Krishna, and then you think, that's as if Krishna personally tailored that for me. And then, after a little further than that, you realize, well, of course he did. He says he does. He says he's going to help you. But at the time, it doesn't feel like help. It feels like a disaster. But afterwards, you can see that, you know, that was very helpful. Yeah.
That's quite a challenge. When I call it for myself, when I find myself in a very physically challenging situation, for example, very sick or ill, we had a situation when someone was giving birth, you know, it's a very painful situation. When we were all sort of like afterwards discussing, the consciousness of the person is actually very incapacitated at the moment. But could be also quite challenging to be Krishna conscious in that situation. So that's also another extreme. I think I prefer to be kind of quite comfortable. I think I could concentrate more on executing Krishna consciousness.
Yes, that's true, but because there's going to be really extreme things happening to us. For example, what's the most extreme thing that's going to happen to you? You have to die. And I think you had that experience recently, to see the profoundness of watching somebody leave this world. The most profound thing, because it's the most convincing, if you're open to it, obvious proof that somebody's not their body. Because the body is right there before you, and there's no more animation will take place. No more relating to that body. All you now do is you take them to the body, to the crematorium. So it's so black and white. Something, some body, whatever you want to say, left. And so these two things are clearly one and the other. So each one of us is going to have to go through that. So sometimes what happens is we do not function very well under stress. I am sure many people don't function well under stress. But ultimate stress is going to be there. And it's said that if you remember Krishna at the time when you're at that kind of crucial final point, then he takes you out of the whole thing. So I read a quote yesterday. I was just sort of chanting and reading, and I saw this quote. It was in the story of Puranjan. And the quote said that if one thinks of his wife at the time of death, this is a very bad thing. Of course, everybody goes, you know, you grieve theoretically, but when you think of my wife or my husband, you don't think like that. And Prabhupada said, because then one is guaranteed not to go back to Godhead. So we hear Prabhupada say so many times, you're guaranteed to go back to Godhead. And here he's saying that one is guaranteed not to go back to Godhead. But we're so careless because we're not mature enough in our devotional thinking. We're not fortunate enough yet to take things that seriously. So we think, anyway, it'll take care of itself. But there's this exam coming, and we don't know when it's coming. And that exam determines what our future suffering and enjoyment will be. We know what our suffering and enjoyment is now, but we don't know what it's going to be in the future. So we're being asked by Krishna, take this examination very seriously. Prepare for it. You don't know when it's coming. It doesn't mean live in fear. It means live in Krishna consciousness. And so we're saying, yeah, well, I sort of would like to and everything, but, you know, it's a bit hard to take that kind of intensity. So then he says, well, I need to help you. And then, of course, at first we say, yes, if it's comfortable. But he's saying, but it's not going to be comfortable then. So take this as an installment, a lesson to be learned. And if you take it rightly, you'll see what I'm doing. I'm trying to prepare you for this so you can come out. But if we don't take it rightly, then we just keep going in. You know, someone's going to pick you up, you go back into the, pull you out, back in. So it's our association is meant to bring that up, to bring us up to the point where we realize that the penny drops, that I'm going to die one day, and what am I going to think of? And Prabhupada would say, if you think I'm going to pass this examination in the fifth grade, you know, I'm going to get a fifth, I'll come into the fifth place, but then you'll come into the seventh place. If you think I'm going to come into the third place, you'll come into the fourth place. It's like you have, if you think, just, you know, it'll happen, it'll be, all it is all good. All these modern kind of, you know, lackadaisical kind of phrases that come along with society. But this one's not going to be like this. This one is 100%. You're going to get your scores. And so you better put something in. That's what I think to myself. I think I better do some work on this, because if real is coming. And so Krishna, very kindly, he's going to give everybody like little lessons to get you ready for that. And that's when you see them as actually good. Not that when the heavy thing is happening, one is completely Krishna conscious and thinks this is wonderful. It's not like that. When it's happening, this is horrible. But I'm learning how to gradually deal properly with a horrible situation, because I think I'll probably find death a little confronting, because I won't be able to breathe anymore. You know? And everybody who I know and love and like and everything, I'm not going to see them again. You know, and this time the medicine's not going to work. You know, the aspirin won't work. The this won't work. Nothing will work. And so I think, you know, as soon as I get a bit of a headache, I quickly run and get an aspirin, and it takes it away. And think, oh, that was. And probably say, you think that was close. But then I think in the back of my mind, there's been a time that I don't want to rely on medicine as my savior, or, you know, because there's been a time that the medicine isn't going to work. So Krishna is making that arrangement for us all to try to get us to become sober. But it's very hard to become sober, because we're living in an intoxicated society. It's very hard to become sober. So he makes personal arrangements. That's how a devotee sees that he's doing this for me. Any other good points? Thank you.
I was thinking how he's. So he's a lizard, he's in a well, which must be pretty ghastly.
Confining.
He knows that he wants to get back to Krishna, that he was very patient, that he didn't become mean and bitter, and that he didn't bite Krishna or the boys when they tried to get him out of the well. That's what I got quite clearly in the beginning and stayed throughout the reading of the story.
That's one of the things I find that's hardest with conditioned souls, not to bite Krishna. Of course you can't, but to try to, you know, to bite the hand that reaches in to help you. Because you're so angry at all the things that have happened to you up till now, and you're blaming them, and you're thinking, ah, it's you at last. Here, take this. This is impiety of ignorance. That one doesn't see properly, and then that mode of passion comes in. That's for a passionate person, for a, you know, an ignorant person may have a different response, but when passion arises, that's the tendency to bite the hand. That's a good point. He didn't bite Krishna, and he waited there patiently until it was time to come out. I was talking to someone today, and I was saying, why do I have to go through this difficulty? And I said, if Krishna took it away from you now, you wouldn't mind very much. Because of the nature of the type of person you are, he's going to leave it with you a lot longer. You get the point. It really say, okay, I've actually got the point. And then you'll say, okay, I'm not needed anymore. Let's forget about this. Let's go on to something else. Because it's not because he loves to hammer and hurt people, but he wants you, this particular person, to get this particular point. So he and that's actually such a favor when he does that. And it's just like in a classroom, if you have students and somebody in the classroom, you take a liking to them, but they're misbehaved. You might put special effort into dealing with their behavioural problems. If you have other children there, you don't really care that much about them. You just sort of tolerate them, or you try to keep them to the side or something. You may not actually invest any effort in trying to reform them. But when Krishna actually takes a special liking to somebody, it's not like he takes a liking to one and not to another. He could take a special liking to everyone. But when he takes a personal special liking to you, then he starts getting heavier. He starts getting heavier. Until that point he said, oh, you don't want to be disturbed? Don't worry, just sit over there and play and cry. Right? Yeah, sit over there and have a good time. Don't worry about anything. You don't have to do anything. But when you start saying, I do actually want to make advancement, it appears sometimes that then he says, okay, I'm going to get heavy with you now. And you think, why? You know, I'm just now going to try and be serious, and you're going to give me a hard time now? You didn't give me a hard time and I was wasting all the time. Why are you giving me a hard time now? Because now I want to train you. You're ready to be trained now.
Aren't there different ways of training
somebody? Yes, definitely. Definitely. But if somebody doesn't learn something, you can either tell them and give them the lesson and say, go ahead and work on it yourself. But if you take a personal interest in somebody, you're going to make sure that they get the message. Not that you're going to beat them to death, but you're going to make sure they get the message. So if they're stubbornly not doing it and you want them to do it, you're going to make it special effort that they get that message. Do you follow what I mean? Not by torturing, but you're going to be ready to be heavy, meaning you're going to be precise and firm with them. You're not going to make a bomb go off on their head, but you want them to get that. Most people don't care.
Why can't it be an enjoyable experience?
It can be an enjoyable experience, but as we're hearing over here, if it's a very, very enjoyable experience, people tend to coast. They tend to kind of like it's fun. They don't necessarily learn it to the deepest level. But certainly everything has an enjoyableness to it in Krishna consciousness. But there's a transformation required of your consciousness from thinking that I'm the center of my life. My life should be centered around me enjoying life however I want. There's another kind of enjoyment, which is to think that actually I'm supposed to serve God. And when He's pleased with me, that should be my happiness. Nobody much knows that. It's a different state of consciousness. They're both enjoyable, but they're different qualities of enjoyment. One is selfish enjoyment, and the other one is something higher than that. So this is the one we're talking about. If somebody is a selfish enjoyer, but they indicate in their heart that they want to come to the other point, if they're not very serious, then you say, yes, that would be nice, do the best you can, and you give them encouragement. But if they go this way and that way instead, you don't really want to interfere, because they're not really that committed. When somebody says, I'm committed, I want this, then you start saying, okay, then you better get serious about this. And look at that. Why don't you work on that as well? You can, and then you start, it becomes very constructive. And the intensity becomes very constructive because now you really want it. Right? It's not a malevolent intensity. It's a benevolent intensity, but it starts to become a very strong relationship. And along with that strong relationship, you trust more. And so you see a kindly hand in things that you would otherwise... other people might not see a kindly hand in, but you can, because you know that this is something that's helping me. That's what we're talking about. Any other? Yes.
How does, if you see in your own association or the association of devotees, if you see devotees undergoing great difficulty and adversity and learning something, and there's a great tendency to fear, well, they need to learn that, and so you avoid being there in a compassionate way for them. How should we deal with devotees who are undergoing great adversity or difficulty? We can understand that Krishna is teaching something.
I think sometimes you may be part of helping them. Sometimes you might not. Sometimes you might have to have a very empathetic feeling towards them, but you may not be part of the infrastructure that's supposed to support them, because you may not have that developed relationship with the person. I see sometimes just practically in the temple where I live, there are certain people who we cross paths, and so if they were having difficulty and I went to talk to them, they would open up because we have some connection. We meet here and there along the way. There are other people I never ever I know how to go, Haribo, and they go, Haribo, and there's not much more than that we have in common. So if that person's suffering, I can talk to somebody, I can see if there's somebody else who may be, but I'm actually not part of their solution directly. So then, do you understand what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
So then my business is to try and see emphatically towards them, and if there's anything that, you know, that could be said or done that would be helpful. But sometimes I'm not part of, I'm not directly part of it, so then it's a matter of empathy. But if you are part of it, I guess the best way to see it is to be able to refer to when you've been in pain and you've had to learn something. And sometimes I can do that and sometimes I can't. I'm speaking just for myself. But it does feel as if when I can do it, Krishna may be more pleased. but you can only do what you can do, but you can understand what would be the ideal thing to do. Because that way then you can at least wish that you could do something better, whereas if you think you don't have any responsibility for them at all, I mean even to care about them, then when somebody, when you're in a position and you feel like everybody feels like that towards you, you feel it's horrible. You know, you wish that at least they'd be, you know, they may not come into your line of approach, but they should at least feel that, oh, I hope he's alright. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're both levels of involvement.
I know the, outside, you know, outside the association, quite often the mood is finally he's learning his lesson. And if you sometimes step in and help somebody, maybe the lesson doesn't go as deep. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think sometimes like that too. And finally he's learning his lesson. You know, don't you think like that with children? Your own children? Sometimes you think finally they're learning their lesson. But does that mean that you dismiss them and you're happy that they're suffering? It's not necessary that has to be there. But sometimes I do. I think with my son, when he says something quietly to myself, I think, finally, he's learning a lesson. You know. But then I say, well, can I help you in some way? But I don't want to remove the difficult situation because I do think it may be part of his learning of a lesson. So that means you don't try to think, I don't try to think that I'm the one who's going to save him from his difficulty. You know, I don't have that power, but I can be, you know, and I might be a little quietly glad as well, but that's not the higher nature, you know, speaking necessarily. Any other practical points from the story? Yes.
I have a question. For a devotee, are they
aspiring devotee, they automatically become a pious person?
Because it thinks that piety is a servant of devotion. Or it encompasses.
Are you saying if they continue on with their devotional service, do they become a pious person? Or are you saying that if somebody comes to devotional service, is it automatic no matter what they do that they become pious?
Can you consider them to be pious?
If they continue on, they automatically become pious, but they go beyond pious. They become perfectly pious. If they continue on with their devotional process. But if they have a tendency towards impiety, which is very rampant in today's day and age, they have their freedom. Like you're saying, you don't have freedom. You have some freedom, you can veer back into impiety. It's not like you get a stamp. No matter what you do after this, you're considered pious. You have to act piously and then you're considered pious. They do have the freedom to act impiously and they do have the freedom to... But the speciality of somebody who's taken up a desire to serve Krishna is that Krishna never leaves them in that point. We read that in the Bhagavatam, even if somebody falls down in the beginning, Krishna, they're not the same as other people because they've once come towards God, is his pleasure, he's not ungrateful. You know, we might be ungrateful, you know, I might be saying, I never liked that person anyway, it's good they're not around anymore. But he's not like that. He follows you. He follows you and waits an opportunity to try to either improve your pious activities so you can come up again, because the piety had something to do with it here, as we heard. But it wasn't, but bhakti doesn't come from piety. Bhakti comes from the desire that he had to see Krishna.
Mm.
And then the piety supported that. So we might have a desire to see Krishna and impiety, and so we'll have a bit of a hard time. We'll stay a devotee, but it'll be a bit of rough. You know. And then, yes, gradually you go beyond piety because of the bhakti. It's what you call the predominance. Yeah.
Does the desire come from this pious activity, or is it desire is just
natural to the soul?
Natural to the soul.
Yeah. The nature of the soul is to love God, but the soul somehow, inconceivably, a very deep subject that we can't go into now. It's as if the soul turns the back to Krishna, and then piety and impiety rules them. Good things, bad things. When they do good things, they get good results. Bad things, they get some punishment, and they're going on like that. But it's as if you have your back to him in your heart. And Krishna consciousness, by the chanting process and by the processes of Krishna consciousness, It's an attempt to bring the living entity to turn around and to actually recognize again that he's my master, he's my lord, he's my dearest, he's my most intimate friend, he's everything to me. And then when that becomes recognized by the soul, then it's the nature of the soul to love him. It's nothing to do with the good and bad things of this world. One time I had a friend, a girl I met, and she was born in a good family. They were a pious Indian family. And she went astray, young, she was very young, and she went into bad company and she did all sorts of things that her family were horrified when they found out about. And so we were talking one time together, and she said to me, when I'm, you know, hearing about Krishna consciousness and things like this, I feel sometimes so guilty, you know, because I think I did all these terrible things, you know, I did awful things. And I said, well, you don't really have to do that. You don't really actually have to do that. What you have to understand is that the good and the bad of this world, they're the same, really, when it all comes down to it. They're both useless, because they have you in the center. You're a good person, you know, you do all things your mother wants, you're a good person, you do all these terrible things, you're a bad person. It's very hard to train yourself to see like this, but I said, everything that you are doing is wrong. All the good and the bad. All that your mother wants and all that your mother doesn't want is wrong. The only thing that is actually pious, is you're developing your love for Krishna. And as you do that, you'll see that the whole thing kind of like falls away. The good and the bad. The value of the good. You don't value it, this is good, this is bad. You see it all as material. It's not for his pleasure, it's not useful for me. And then do you throw it away? No. But you implant this idea that I want to please him by what I'm doing instead of I want to do it for myself. That's what Krishna consciousness is about. You change the object from me for my selfish enjoyment to him for his pleasure. And then the activities, they become transformed by that change of consciousness. It's subtle, but it's very, very, very powerful. Any other? Yes.
There's many examples in the scripture of great devotees who in the past have had very great difficulties in their spiritual life to the extent where they become fallen and covered. But then later on we see they rise to deep beyond that and become very powerful and respected.
Yeah.
What are some of the points that even we see amongst even devotees of our own ilk or whatever, who have difficulty? What are the points where we begin to recognize and leave behind or to see with compassion? Or what are the points that, you know, that make that devotee significant to rise again and to be recognized?
What do you mean, what are the points?
What are the significant elements of the person's character?
What makes that happen?
What are the elements of that
their
person's character?
Yeah. It brings them up again?
Which allows them to be again, be respected and seen.
One. There's only one thing. Keep going. It's the only thing. You just keep going. Because what happens is impious activities, they're of this world. So impious activities have a reaction. It has a certain amount of time. Like, I can't think of a good example, but it has a certain amount of time. At the end of that time, that's over already. And it's no longer, it doesn't rule and govern you anymore. So if you just keep going, if you've made a mistake, and you keep going, keep serving, even though you might be serving with so many faults, and you're serving this way, and people may even be annoyed with you because you're serving in such a way, or whatever, but you keep serving, keep serving, keep serving. At a certain point, you're reinstated on the up. It's like as if you're going and you go down, stay down, or you hover down for a little while, and you come up again, and you keep going again, and then as your service, because it's gaining strength from your going through the difficulty of keeping serving when you don't feel like you're worthy of, or whatever you're feeling, but you keep being steady like that, then you start to get, from even that down, you start to get an up. And if you keep serving, when you go up, you won't get proud then. And forget that I was down at one time, now I'm up, and you won't get proud of the up, and you're depressed about the down. You just keep serving, because that's what you've been doing all the time. You keep serving, keep serving, keep serving, you up and down, and you keep serving. And all you know is I've got to keep serving. And other people might look and say, oh, or oh, but you just know I have to keep serving. Because that's my dharma, that's my essential nature. I have to keep doing that.
Seems to take quite a lot of time for devotees to, especially people in positions of authority, to again re-accept personalities who continue to serve. And
no, we just keep serving. It depends, of course, how severe, and how it depends how much and something is an error, and how much it is. What do they call that? There's two types of a, one is when calculated
premeditated.
Is how premeditated something was. If something was premeditated and suddenly you find out that was going on, when people find that out, then of course to the degree that it was this, that's the degree that they may be doubtful. But when an error or a problem, it comes from circumstantial, then you keep serving. It's funny, it's really true, you'll exhaust the reactions to something. I mean, I know it personally. And all of a sudden everyone's saying, oh, you're really helping me so much. Is it me? Do you know who I am? They're going, wow, it's like funny. It's time is like that. Krishna's very mysterious. Like you might be feeling very, very fallen and somebody meets you right now. They don't know about you. They meet you right now. They'd like you. You help them right now. They start giving you appreciation and gratitude because you've helped them right now. And then it heals. You just keep giving, keep serving, keep pleasing Krishna, trying to please Krishna, and keep thinking, as Manjupa was saying, I'm so fallen. My gosh, I'm fallen. I can't believe how fallen I am. That's humility. That has to come. That's the Madhyamadhikari thinks like that. The beginner thinks, oh, I'm doing great. But the Madhyamadhikari thinks, and then the really advanced devotee, they're thinking, everybody's better than me. There's no one that's not serving Krishna except me. I'm awful. So how can that be? That's because their heart is so free of any. It seems contradictory. Their heart is free from any sin, and they think I'm just like a mountain of sin. I'm such a horrible person. But their humility is matured, and that humility is another characteristic of the soul. To feel very meek and humble is a characteristic of the soul. And how do you feel like that? For his pure soul, because they see Krishna and he's unlimitedly wonderful, and they know I'm just teeny tiny, so they just feel I'm so small, I can't do anything, he does everything, I'm just, and they're so peaceful. And once you think I'm really good, you're so troubled because you've got to make sure everybody else thinks I'm good, and you've got to get rid of somebody who thinks that you're not good, and you've got to wheel and deal and work this out of the way and move that over there. And it's all centered around an image of yourself. And so that, to a serious devotee, that looks like hell. They don't envy that. They just think, oh, that's awful. You know, poor person, actually. Mm-hmm. They might be wielding a high position, but you think, I wouldn't like to have to do that. I'd rather become simple, small, and know I'm really fallen, and just tell Krishna, please help me. I'm trying to do the best I can. I want to be your servant. There's so much freedom there, it's amazing. But the other one, there's so much tension. So he's trying to get us to go down that route, like we're saying, not only by torturing us, not only by, it can be pleasant. Definitely can be pleasant, there can be very sweet things exchanged. But as long as we're resisting, it's harder for it to be pleasant, because we're pulling back in Krishna. So he might leave us alone, so we can relax and, you know, but then when he leaves us alone, often we say, okay, thank you, that's great, now I'm off. And you go in the opposite direction. So then if he's caring for you, he might say, no, I want you to do this. You know, when you're training a child, sometimes you have to be more firm than you'd like to be, but it's for the long-term benefit of the child. If you had your way, you would play and have fun all day. but the child won't benefit from that, so therefore you have to do something different. Say something. You had many wise words.
Regarding humility, some years back, Bhakti Vaibhav Puri Maharaj passed through town. Someone was bringing him from Ahmedabad on his way to Vrindavan, so he stopped for a couple of days and he stayed with us. So when he pulled up, I opened the car door for him and he immediately got out and did his dandavats, put him inside, fed him, he did his dandavats again. He wanted to go to Govindaji's, so I drove him into town. Then when we left the temple, when we were getting back in the car, he grabbed my feet and thanked me for taking him to Govindaji. I mean, you know, the man's about 80 years old.
Mm.
But when you see someone that's genuinely humble like that, it's really disarming.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel
yeah.
this big. There's a man that's been a sannyasi most of his life.
Mm.
Was
so
quite liked by Prabhupada too.
Yeah. So his humility created humility in you. It didn't create pride in you, it created a smallness in you.
you start to realise how insignificant you actually are.
Even though he's offering you praise. He's like putting you up and because of his humility, you go down. Naturally go down, not down in a horrible guilty way, but you just feel your own unworthiness in comparison to his vast amount of culture and respect. So we have so much to learn, That's what I keep thinking, we have so much to learn. So we just learn our little lesson, whatever the next little lesson is, just learn that. And then learn the next little lesson, and gradually we become what Srila Prabhupada wanted. But we've got, somebody might be thinking, oh, I've just started being a devotee, I'm way behind, I'll never catch up. But actually as you go on, everyone should feel like that. And then something becomes very nice about devotee association. We should all feel like that. And when you see somebody who's lived in the culture their whole life, you can either get depressed and think, oh, I'll never be there. Or you can say, maybe I won't, but I'm going to keep trying. That's what I'm saying, keep going. And then my husband always says to me, whenever I get, up or down or backwards and forwards and around, he always says to me, what are you supposed to be doing right now? What's your service, right? Have you heard him say that? What's your service right now? And then he brings you back to right this minute, what am I supposed to be doing? And then I start trying to, I'm supposed to be doing this, I start going to do that. And then it sort of settles the feelings of hopelessness or anxiousness. It just, again, makes me put my attention right here. Okay, let me do this. I can actually do this. I can't do this, I can't do that, but I can do this. So do it. And in that way, just that one thing. And I was listening to a tape, Radhanathaswami, and he was saying that too. The most important thing is, stay in the association of devotees, no matter what happens, because everyone's going to have their trips and tumbles and falls and so on and so forth. As soon as you go away from association of devotees, it becomes very difficult. But if you stay, it will all be cleared. I think it must be time to take a shower.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you very much.
Could you just remind us of the two things you said to forget and the two things to remember?
Oh, I'll try. I think he said you should immediately forget all the good things you've done for people and all the bad things they've done to you. You should forget that. And you should remember, one of them was that you're going to die, and the other one, I'm not quite sure what it was something about all the maybe the good things they've done to you. If you ever want to improve your relationship with devotees, you think, I really need to improve my devotee relating, then just go and get tapes from Radhanathaswami and listen to them until they penetrate. At first you'll find your mind will go, no, I can't do that. You can do that, I can't do that. But you just listen and listen and listen and listen, because he's so much in the mood And at first I find my mind says, this is sentimental, I can't cope with this, I don't know. And then after some time it starts to sort of calm down, and it listen, and I listen, and it affects. One Indian boy who's coming, who we know, who was coming in Perth to the temple, he said one time that if I want to intensify my appreciation for the holy name, I get a tape of Iyengar. Said, if I want to intensify my appreciation for devotees, I get a tape of Radhanasami, because that's his whole meditation, his association of devotees. And he said, and if I, he had another one because he was from England, he said, if I want to get more deeply philosophically focused, then I listen to Radhagovindaswami. So he was, it was interesting, he had all these different people whose tapes he listens to for, to strengthen that particular quality, because they have that quality, that's why. It's not sort of a sentimental thing. They're expert in that. This one is very good at that. This one's very good at that. So when I listen to them, something will rub off. So he's very encouraging in how to associate together.
Can I just make one last comment? Was what you said was saying that was interesting. I've been thinking about it. And I was thinking the earlier comment, if you see someone going through something, then if it's Krishna's arranging them to go through it, then no matter what we do, we can't stop them from going through it. So that's to turn it the other way around. But it gives us a chance, it's a lesson for us to then be compassionate no matter, because Krishna's already got the lesson, you know, he's taken care of that, but the lesson for us is then to be able to show compassion during that time.
Another thing that I thought of when just you were saying that was that if I see somebody and I know I can't, I don't really know them well enough to really get, you know, I don't know what to do, then I often take it to the deities and say, is there anything I'm supposed to do to help you? I don't know what to do. And I've got a very hard, harsh heart, and I'm always thinking, good, that's right. So I admit that, and then I say, is there anything I can do? Being this, is there anything I can do to help? I honestly state my position. I don't hide it, and I don't ignore it. I express it, because it's from there only that I can go up. So I have to be there, and then I can improve. So oftentimes people don't want to see something because it's too painful, or they don't know something. So then they're not accurately situated when they're going to make. So they don't pray usually. The people who actually develop a mood of praying to the deities, they usually have to be grounded in, this is how I feel, I'm this kind of person, I'm not a very nice person, I love seeing people, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I love seeing people unhappy, I lie, I'm a perpetual liar, I'm this, I'm that, there's a song. So when you hear that song, you think, yes, you know. And at first when we come, we think, I'm not like that. I'm such a nice person. I love devotees. I'm always, you know, on and on and on. But later you start to see, why am I standing here and not wanting to move, you know, and don't want anyone to see me? You know, it's because I'm this and I'm this and I'm this, and I've been able to see that. But then you go to the acharyas, they're saying it already. So that means that they've gone through that to a point that that's assimilated into their humble attitude. So they're giving me the opportunity to do that too, go through the experience to the other side. But there's some honesty and humility. You've got to start from where you're at, and then you can go from there. Something like that.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna, thank you.